Hello and welcome to Advocate, a podcast channel by ASEAN Parliamentarians for Human Rights, or APHR. On this channel, we talk about some of the most important human rights and democracy issues affecting Southeast Asia. My name's Veronica Pedroza, and I'm here to talk about the upcoming Philippines election with two guests that have much to say about what's at stake in this crucial moment of the country's history. Before we go into the discussion, I just want to take you out into the streets of Manila to give you a sense of the incredible interest that people here have in the outcome of this vote on May the 9th. This is the sound of a big rally in the iconic Manila Bay. It's for Leni Robredo. She's a candidate that's claimed the color pink for her presidential campaign, so everyone's dressed in pink, enjoying the concert and the speeches. But underlying the enthusiasm of the voters is a deep anxiety, which I tried to get to the bottom of when I sat down with a couple of fascinating experts.
These elections are really capturing the imagination of the Philippine people. Everybody is talking about them here. So I'm really pleased that we've got this opportunity to talk about it with our esteemed guests. Do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, please, Etta?
I'm Etta Rosales. Currently, I'm lecturing in the College of St. Benilde. I was a former chair of the Commission on Human Rights, and I was active in the fight against the Marcos dictatorship.
And Etta, you were a victim of martial law abuses yourself.
I was a tortured victim, but I survived. And after surviving, I continued the fight, but I did it above ground. And up to now, I continue the fight against what I consider a very autocratic rule of Mr. Duterte.
Louis, would you like to tell us a bit about yourself?
Well, I am Louis Guia. I used to be a commissioner at the Philippine Commission on Elections, or COMELEC. I now teach election law at the De La Salle University. Prior to my being in government and being in COMELEC, I was involved in a lot of civil society activities, promoting electoral reforms and doing election monitoring, among which would be the Legal Network for Truthful Election.
Let's hear what an actual candidate has to say about what's at stake in these elections. I met up with Walden Bellio, a vice presidential candidate and, full disclosure, a board member of APHR at a much smaller meeting. It was with what they call here an urban poor community, at risk of having their informal settlement demolished because a billionaire property developer wants to build on the land. Walden explained why human rights as such haven't been an important issue in the campaign.
We do have to address the question of basic needs and poverty and inequality, because unless we address those, the idea of human rights becomes quite abstract to people. So economic rights as part of the complex of human rights, this is what people care about. And, you know, when it comes to lives being taken, extrajudicial execution, torture, for people who have not experienced those, it's a bit abstract. But I think that once you connect it to economic rights and see it as a whole complex of rights, then people begin to understand that more. But my sense is that it's very, very important to begin from people's economic needs.
What do you think, Etta? Do you agree with what Walden said?
Yes, of course. Definitely. Because I've been in, you know, when you speak of human rights, you have to talk about the entirety, the entire range of human rights. So I agree with him that unless you are able to link what they feel, the hunger, the poverty, to their rights as a claim holder, it will be very abstract for them. But really, even the right to security, to be secure in their homes, is very, you know, much linked to, you know, the hunger that they feel. Because when he talked about extrajudicial killings, summary killings, this was really penetration of the privacy of their homes, because these were the humble dwellings of the poor people in the urban areas.
Louis, do you think that it's because of a failure to explain the relevance of human rights that we have, as the leading candidate, a man, Bongbong Marcos Jr., who is leading the race for the presidency and who has supported his father's legacy, which, of course, is marked by martial law and by human rights abuses right across the land?
You know, like Etta, I agree with the statement of vice presidential candidate Walden Bellew. There has got to be an effort to connect the concept of human rights with the gut issues. One of the most important things that candidates should be doing, at least those candidates who would want to present a human rights, should I say, perspective, or would want to question the human rights abuses that characterized the regime of Marcos. And now we have a candidate who represent the perspective of authoritarianism. I think it's important to connect it to gut issues, to issues that matter to citizens, issues that have something to do with their ordinary lives, peace and security, for instance, in communities. And that's why sometimes abuses seem to be something that does not really incite rage upon the people, because there is a real threat of security caused by our drug problems. And there has to be a counter narrative that recognizes the problem felt by ordinary people.
So my question would be, is it because candidates have failed to provide that narrative, linking human rights to everyday lives, that we have somebody leading the presidential race who has clearly condoned, refuses to apologize for the abuses that happened during his father's time and indeed his predecessor's time?
You know, what's his name? Marcos Jr., Ferdinand Marcos Jr. The son doesn't know a thing about human rights in the first place. Neither does the current president. So to say that people don't understand human rights because Marcos can get away with murder at the rate that he's going is, you know, an understatement. What Marcos Jr. is doing right now is a lot of disinformation, which is a gross violation of the rights of the people to information. So to add to what Louis had said, human rights is not just all about, you know, linking it to your stomach. It is also about linking it to your right to the truth. So when you speak of free and fair elections, there's an obstacle already. There's an obstacle to your right to information, to find out exactly who the candidates are, what their platforms really are.
This is a good point in our discussion then to turn to Gemma Mendoza, who's been studying this for Rappler.com.
Basically, what we're looking at here is not a level playing field. And this is not just about the Marcos and martial law disinformation. You're talking here of the amount of attacks that the second contender has been subjected to over the years. And that's very misogynistic attack. Before we make vital decisions, we assess information, right? We look at, is this candidate qualified? Does he have the right skills? He or she have the skills that we need, the background that we need? Those are things we base decisions on when we're talking about leaders. And all of that is based on myth-making, in effect. We're seeing a leading candidate who, in terms of qualifications, it's been proven that his credentials are questionable. It's been proven over and over again. But why is it not sinking in, right? And weirdly, the second contender is being accused of being a stupid person. It's the weirdest election in all. Normally, media would compare, right? We are comparing credentials, we're comparing the statements that are made, we're comparing track record, we're comparing. These are things that are workflow already if you're a journalist. But all of that doesn't matter. Right now, we're looking at how do you break through the tissue of lies, that membrane that's already been somehow laid down over years through that blanket of layers and layers of attacks and disinformation.
You know, during that same conversation with Gemma, she told me that there are a lot of lawyers looking at bringing cases around disinformation during this campaign. I wouldn't be surprised if legal cases emerge after the election. Louis, what can be done about disinformation, in fact?
Our legal framework in election is not prepared to address this new phenomenon. It's also a question that has been raised within the election legal circle as to how this information can be addressed. And the approach has always been to look for reforms in our election legal framework. So there has been proposals probably revisit how, you know, information in election needs to be looked at as it impacts on the process. And that has not been in the template of legal remedies available in cases of election mischief.
Adding to that, that explains why the ratings of Marcos Jr. are way above that of the rest of the crowd, because his ratings are anchored on all this disinformation, and this has been fed to the poor people. They believe it. I had people who have been interviewing me from Hong Kong, and they said, Etta, do you know, in Hong Kong, they believe that there's the Yamashita gold. And he promises to give back the Yamashita gold the moment he wins. In any event,
I think you need to explain what the Yamashita gold is.
Well, Yamashita was a general in the Philippines, and he was supposed to have the gold, a lot of gold in the Philippines before he was caught. And so everybody is now looking for the Yamashita gold. So anyway, the ratings of Marcos have gone up because the D and E crowd, would say, yes, we'll vote for him, we'll vote for him. So he's got 56%, 53%. And that is how he has been able to continue and maintain his high ratings as against any real political platform that he has to offer the people for a change, to bring about the kind of change and restoration of democratic governance.
Are we saying then that the results of these elections will be necessarily invalid, Louis?
Well, I mean, legally, to say that it is invalid is different from saying that whether people will accept them, even if the formal processes have been complied with. Because it all boils down to how many people would actually cast their vote. The burden, difficult as it is, to overcome the lies and the disinformation needs to be met head on. And that is by having effective political communication. If you want to relate all of these things, human rights, then it has to be communicated in a way that is understandable.
To add to that, you know, we have a Bill of Rights. That's civil and political rights. The Bill of Rights is basic because it talks about individual sovereignty, the sovereignty of the individuals to be able to vote for the person that they want to be elected into office, and the sovereign right of the individual to run for office and be elected. And it should be through honest, transparent, responsible, and accountable electoral process. That's what it's all about. That is why we say that human rights is the cornerstone of governance, of democratic governance. It is the foundation itself. You know, the people are not stupid. If you talk to them nicely and they feel free and they don't feel threatened at all, then they start to understand. Because poor people have had the experience of manual work, of struggle, and they know what it is. It is easy to explain things to them. This is their Bill of Rights, their civil and political and social rights.
Of course, a lot's changed since the Marcos martial law era. Patricia Abinales, professor at the School for Pacific and Asian Studies at the University of Hawaii Manoa, has interesting things to say about this.
Human rights groups are having a hard time associating political violence to human rights violation because of the people who are perpetrating it. but also because political clans have found a way to resolve differences, not through violence, but by creating new provinces. If you look at the numbers of provinces that have been set up since 1986, almost always the division is a result of political clans trying to resolve their differences. And so in the regional and local level, they're like, you know, different groups of mafia, you know, families sitting down and said, okay, let's run the economy this way, let's run politics this way. Conflict doesn't help us. The Godfather part one. Where is the violence happening? It's happening in the barangay, the village level. You know, assassinations of candidates and opponents running for a barangay, a village, you know, captain position. And that is something that national media isn't interested about. You know, it's one local kid in a barrio in northern Luzon or Mindanao. There's actually a gradual increase in the number of people being killed. And the question then is, if you were a Roma human rights activist, how would you connect killing at the local villages to a larger issue of human rights violation, especially if the killings are related to elections? And so I think that's the main dilemma of human rights movement in the Philippines now. It was easier in the Marcos time because you had people who are detained, and therefore, you know, you can rally Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, your cause. And, you know, these are, they may be communists, but they're fighting the government. Marcos was a dictatorship. You know, they may be, come from different ideological parties or, you know, are human rights lawyers. But, you know, there was always this black and white thing. You are either for the Marcos dictatorship. This one is so dissipated, though. It's much more difficult to find a target.
What did you think about what Professor Abinales said?
Yes, government is so decentralized. It's true that we're so spread out and scattered. That's all true. And much of it, too, Veronica, has to do with the indifference and the apathy of certain sections, even in the middle class. Because, you know, when he was talking about people were not interested in the summary killings of the poor people at the barangay level, that isn't exactly true. Because in the beginning, when all these extrajudicial killings were taking place, that made a lot of noise. And media was very, very interested in bringing it out in the open. And these were homeless, slum dwellers. These were very poor people. These were peddlers of drugs, it is true. And some of them really took in drugs because they were hungry. The little children would take in drugs so that they would not be so hungry when they go to school. But certain sections of the middle class actually supported the war policy in the beginning. And why? Because they felt that they did not like, you know, drug addicts within their neighborhood. So they were in favor of death penalty, as if to say that the core problem of criminality in the Philippines was, you know, the drug addicts, which isn't true. Sure, also have their crimes committed, but it's not as if it's all about addicts. So that was the case. It was only for some time when the middle class started, you know, being aware that things were not really good, as good as what Duterte kept on saying. And yes, it's true that in the rural areas, you don't hear much about it, as things that happen in Metro Manila, of course, which is the center of everything.
For me, I look at the elections and I find it very depressing looking at how politics has evolved in the years since martial law, to the point where we have the son of the worst abusers during the martial law coming along and being able to claim the presidency. I don't know if you feel the same way.
Of course, but I do not allow myself to be depressed. We have to have hope. And there is hope. There is hope, but it's difficult. You know, Veronica, there's this, what's his name, Lawrence Cohen. Are you familiar with him? He's a folk singer in the United States. And he says, "Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light comes in." And that's what's taking place right now. It's not depressing. It's difficult, but there is some hope. There's a possibility that Marcos Jr. might win, and his victory will be a result of what we have been talking about. Should that happen, what are we going to do? We're going to continue with the resistance. We're going to continue with educating the people because that's what it's all about. But there is also a chance that we might win the elections if enough energy is consolidated. A lot of people are now coming to Lenny Robredo's camp because they realize governance that is of the people by, you know, what Lincoln has been saying, by the people for the people. And empowerment starts from the grassroots and they participate in the process of governance. Supposing she wins, it's not going to be easy. It's going to be very difficult, but it's going to be a victory that will mean that people can now have hope. This is the hope that they have. So don't be depressed, Veronica.
How about you, Louis? Are you depressed?
I was about to be depressed and I'm thinking of migrating. But when you see and experience the kind of voluntary effort by citizens in a campaign right now, this is unprecedented. This has never been observed in any previous elections that we have. And that is a source of hope. And I think whatever the result of the election would be, this is something that we can bring after the elections and continue to fight against, you know, abuses of human rights and authoritarianism. We just have to make sure that the momentum stays even after election, whatever the result. I'm just sad that, you know, we're talking about the weaknesses of our electoral processes, of our democracy, and some of the requirements to fix this would have to be policy reform. But if we do not elect the right people in government, then there goes your policy reform. So it becomes a chicken and egg situation. That is what gives me nightmare. But, you know, seeing people willing to do things in a voluntary way gives hope.
It's been such an interesting discussion. Thanks very much, Louis and Etta, for, you know, sharing your expertise. I guess I'll see you down at the polling stations. Do you want to make any predictions about what's going to happen on May the 9th?
Well, I don't want to make any prediction. What I know is that I'm going to go there and vote, and I want to see a lot of other people voting, exercising their right, and then let's see what's going to happen, and I remain hopeful.
And in my case, I'm also going to vote, but I hope that, you know, I remain hopeful, but I hope that the vigilance of the people will continue, because as others put it, others might try to cheat and so on, you know, but I hope that the people will always be vigilant and that I hope that the truth comes out in the elections and the truth will be in favor of good governance, accountable governance, and leadership that matters.
That was Etta Rosales ending the discussion that we had with Louis Guia. We also heard from Professor Patricio Abinales, Gemma Mendoza, and Walden Bellio. Christina Uy Gadaingan and Carlos Sardinia Galache produced this episode of Advocate, a podcast by ASEAN Parliamentarians for Human Rights. Thanks very much also to our donors, the Open Society Foundations and the Swedish International Development Cooperation Agency. We hope you enjoyed listening, and if you did, please share this episode. Bye!